Unreal. Uncensored. Unradio.
Cliffcentral.com.
I'm Adrian Groenewald. This is the Leadership Masterclass. And the first half hour, we spoke reputation management. That podcast you can always get. Our special guest in the studio with myself, Alison Yandu, and Louis Groenewald is Iman Rapetti. Iman, welcome.
Hey, hello. You said something about leader. I thought maybe disruptor, rabble rouser.
Well, I have that question for you just now. Do you see yourself as a leader? But we'll get there. What does it feel like sitting on? You don't sit on that side of the microphone.
No, I don't. It's very uncomfortable. I hate it. Ellis?
How are you?
I hate
doing
it. How are you?
Long time.
Uncle Louis, nice to see you.
Well, they say the worst people to interview are interviewers.
Yeah, because we're trying to see around the curve. Because I know when you're asking me a question, you've got a follow-up question behind it. So I want to be there. I want to race ahead so I can trip you up rather than you tripping me up.
Yeah, you could probably tell me what all my questions are already. No, but just tell us, who is Iman Rapetti? I mean, first of all, you must have flown to get here. You were here like a few minutes early. Your show ends at 12.
Do you have a blue light brigade?
Listen, I do not have, although, you know, some people got blue light brigades, we are told, from Wanderers Stadium to their house in Saxonwell. So I heard it. On
who's
our radio
that?
Station.
Who's that?
No, it was one of our callers that called in one day. It's an allegation, of course. I don't know how that ended because our journalist is still working on the story. So I don't have that luxury.
They're now gone anyway.
Yeah? So no, I kept the rules, Adrian. I'm a law-abiding citizen of this country. And it's an important question you raise. I know it comes out of, you know, just trying to inject some levity. But when we start to break down the simple things like a bribe or circumventing process or something, I think that's where the slow decline and decay happens in society. And we end up like society in the world where just to buy anything or to do anything, you've got to grease someone's palm. So it's the small things that matter in a country like ours.
Very true. You're not going to get away from the question, who is Iman Rapetti? I met you, I don't know, I think I've met you once or twice maybe, but I liked you. There was a warmth, and I want to know, where does that come from? Who are you? Where do you come? I mean, just tell us, who's Iman Rapetti? Actually, on the internet, not a lot on Google about you, to be honest.
Really?
It's not a lot personal anyway, so I don't want to get too personal, but just tell us who you are.
I don't know. You know, I find that those questions are usually best answered by people that are surrounding the person. So a brother, a sister, a friend, a parent, because they'll give you a more honest review. I will maybe try to be self-effacing, maybe self-deprecating, or I might be egotistical and narcissistic. So let me see. If I'm trying to be really honest, I'm a woman who strongly believes in issues around women, about affirming ourselves. I grew up in a very poor community. We didn't have a lot of opportunity. Grew up in that kind of dichotomy of interrace in a place like South Africa, in a community like Phoenix in KZN, where, you know, you never quite fit in. So those were very much early themes of mine, dealing with class issues, those who had and those who didn't have, learning how to navigate all of those things. And I think the one thing for me is that I'm part ghetto, part boardroom. You know, I often use that dichotomy because I do. There's a street sensibility about where I come from because every time I go home, I see how things in my community have not changed. And then you rub shoulders with the likes of yourself, Janine, who's a good friend of mine, Ellis and Myanda. We get to travel overseas. Absolutely. Ellis and I won a junket not so long ago. You're living a kind of life that people in your community may never touch, may never have the opportunity to have access to.
That could divorce you from them very easily. It happens often, doesn't it?
So I think maybe the best word, and Janine's nodding and she'll probably nod at this, is real. I'm just a real person. I don't have a lot of affectations or, you know, highfalutin opinions about myself. I try to be as real and as connected to anything I'm doing or anyone I'm talking to
maybe
in the moment.
Maybe that's what I sensed. So how do you stay real? Do you have a conscious way or are you just lucky? You just stay real and authentic and genuine and down to earth?
I think your heart's got to be open all the time. We spend a large portion of our lives, you know, recalibrating who we are. And sometimes we can err on the side of cynicism because we might be disillusioned by what we see or we recognize our own powerlessness in situations. But if our heart is always open and we don't always try to speak for other people, we literally try to learn and see the world through their eyes. There's a humility that comes with that because it means you put down your own words and your way of describing things because you have a notion about something. It's never to make assumptions about people. It's really to listen and to take what they are saying to you. And I patchwork my experiences with those of other people. It greatly affects me if somebody calls, and you know I have a radio show from a place like Soshanguve, or let's take Somalia Park. There's a gentleman that called by the name of Raymond once. And I could almost see his shack. I could see that he was disabled. He was telling us the story about how he was lying in his human excrement for 8 days because nobody bothered to visit him. Nobody knew that he was suffering and in need. And his story, I felt superimposed itself on me and my psyche. And that's the way we stay real, is by being open to people in our society, in our communities.
Journalism, you sometimes get the impression very good journalists and anchors are hard and tough, and they have to be. Even Jeremy, he comes tough, you know, straight to the jugular. You'd probably find maybe softer in real life, but you haven't lost that. And that's not
easy. Do I still appear vulnerable? I need to work on that.
I think you do. No. We'll talk about that in a moment. I think, as I've said to you before, just spontaneous feedback, I've seen you grow as an interviewer. Not that I'm this big interviewer who can judge others, but I've seen you grow. And before we go there, 2 minutes, you went to Iran for 2 years. How did that? Why did you go there? Why? And how did that impact you as a human being?
That's another show.
It's a whole other show, and my mother needs to stop listening because it represents a painful chapter in my family's life, because I was choosing a path that was taking me away from them. I changed religions, I changed continents, I changed the way I looked, the way I talk, the way I spoke, and so on. Incidentally, there's a rerun on I think it's Encore, the Encore channel, with me in an interview with Felicia Mabuza-Suttle, with my then husband. And some of the stuff that I said, I think, oh my gosh, did I really say that? Why is it still like available in the public domain? But yeah. I went because I was following my own heart. And I think here's the important thing, Adrian. We often become pigeonholed by people. So the Adrian, as you said, you know, the Adrian of 10 years ago is not the same Adrian of today, because you've changed. You've taken on board people's perceptions. Ellis, you're not the same. You have been changed. And I find it a little bit disingenuous if we strictly hold people to what they said 10 years ago. Obviously, if it's a blatantly racist position or, you know, something really destructive, but points of views are fluid. And it shows growth in human beings when we change our minds about things. And we can honestly say, what I said then, I don't mean anymore, because I've changed in this way.
We hold people to it when it suits us, you see. Julius Malema told me personally, even if I get expelled, I will never leave the ANC. Then he does. I can now call him, I don't know, what can I call him? I can
say,
you've got no integrity, you lie. But
it won't be true.
The context changed. But I still think but the context changed. And you can actually go very far with that argument, can't you? I mean, you can... I don't know. Let's not come with examples, but a good point. In social media, nothing goes away. In today's world, nothing goes away. You type in Iman Rapeti and there's something there that you might want to disappear, but it doesn't.
Yeah, and that's why so sorry, Ellis.
No. It's an interesting point. I read something in one of these tech books saying the internet never forgets. Mm. And that's very crucial, I think, to the topic
we're talking
about earlier, reputation.
Yeah.
What you said once, you know, it might be held against you. But as you say, it's not fair.
But I think, you know, justice is a keen thing, along with having your heart open to people, Uncle Louis, is what is just in the situation. So what is a fair measure of someone? And if we are fair-minded and sensible in how we deal with people, I think we'll be okay, because we can make a fairly rational conclusion about someone, or evaluation about someone, if we've watched their journey and we've seen them being open. I mean, as you said, you know, you raised Julius Malema, and we know he's always a fiery person. And yes, that's what he believed at one point. He's, you know, his points of view have evolved tremendously over the last few years, and he very much firmly believes what he says. And I wish that I always had the courage of my own convictions, because I always err on the side of trying to be fair, trying to be objective, trying to always, maybe I overthink it, trying to say the right thing. But you asked about Iran, and it was, it was about following my heart. I wanted to know more about the Iranian Revolution, and I had an amazing couple of years in Iran studying religious law at a university in Qom, which is the desert. My son was born there. I couldn't speak a word of Persian. All I could say was Mimiram, you know, I'm going to die. And the nurses laughed at me, and they're like, you're not going to die. And I didn't die, thankfully. My son was born there. So I learned the language. I learned the culture of people, and that was also instructive. When you don't immerse yourself in someone's life and the way they live, it's very hard for you to understand, because you'll always be a tourist there. But when you get closer to people and you eat what they eat, you speak in the way that they speak, you share their experiences in that way, it approximates you. And that's what's missing in South Africa, I think. From where we're sitting here in Sandton, you know, how approximated are we to the real experiences of people who may not have what we have, may not live where we live, may not associate with the people we associate with?
And that's a very good leadership principle, is your ability to stay connected. I think that's where President Zuma lost it potentially, but you can't but lose it sometimes, because protocol takes over.
Yeah.
You can't just stop at a police station. You can't just be real and be authentic, and that frustrates the hell out of me, how leaders allow it to happen.
Iman, my question for you is, where do you get all this energy?
It's pressure every day, though.
I mean, as an editor, a former editor of a newspaper, there's just things I couldn't get to, because you're always doing something, but you seem to be doing everything.
I don't know. I'm so conscious of my mortality. I'm so conscious that this all ends now. As human beings, we are the most fragile species on Earth. I did a soliloquy about tardigrades. They're one of the most hardy creatures in biology. Mm-hmm. They will survive being taken to freezing, below freezing temperatures, and they will survive being boiled. But the one thing that's missing from them is that they don't have the ability to have empathy like we do. Mm-hmm. But I'm aware of our mortality. I'm aware that I want to do as much as I can every day. And I try as much as I can. It's my own philosophy, is to, I don't know, just make some difference in the world every day to someone. It doesn't need to, when we think about making a difference, we think big names. We think the Mandelas and whatever you think of Gandhi, we think of the Gandhis and we think of all of those kinds of revolutionaries really in the world. But actually big change can be the charity that you do to someone. Mm-hmm. It can be whether you love what you do, you love your work, or I love being alive. Mm-hmm. I love being alive. And if I drop dead, you know, once I leave the studio, I think I'll be satisfied.
Because, I mean, you've got, what is it, 2 or 3 hours live on ENCA almost every night?
3 every night there, 3 hours in the morning on radio.
Live on radio, Power FM. All of that must be filled with, now the evening is probably a little bit more current news and so on. The radio is topical issues, but more in-depth discussion maybe. So, yeah. That is pressure. That really is. You've got teams around you, of course. You've got producers, whatever else. But that is pressure. Every day, live, visible. First your voice in the mornings, and then your voice and your face and your body and how you dress in the evenings. It's not in everyone's character or ability to do that.
Well, I'm glad I could walk into the studio with my duk and no makeup on, pretty much, Adrian, because, you know, there's a great freedom in that. In the evening, you know, you got to get all dicked up and whatever.
Yeah, no,
but I think the big challenge for me is I'm conscious of not wanting to let our listeners down. And because the scope of subjects is so vast, they could talk about anything. I'm okay with saying, listen, I don't know that. Does anyone else know? Can anyone share? And that's, I think maybe it's dangerous, but I do allow myself to be vulnerable on air. I'm not the know-it-all. I'm not the repository of every kind of everything that people want to know about. But you have to be prepared. And I know that you guys are very much always immersed in news. So you have to have, you know, a fair sense of ability to segue between different subject matter. So you have to read extensively. And I love reading. My children love reading. So I involve myself with reading as much as I possibly can so that I'm prepared in the moment. In the evening, it's better because, as you said, it's ring-fenced content unless there's breaking news.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's,
which you handle with aplomb as well.
Oh, thank you.
You make it look so easy.
But, you know, again, you have to have a starting point. So sure. You have to know historically. So it takes, you know, for journalists, I think, to be really good is to have a great archival knowledge, and that you have to keep fresh all the time. And that does take work. And that's why I'm anxious in the morning. What will they say now? And am I going to be prepared?
Well, I guess the authenticity there again, if you're not really passionate about news and current affairs and issues and the society you live in and the people, and then you'll be in trouble. Because you literally have to. That's where Gareth Cliff is so brilliant. He's just, general knowledge is huge. He just reads a hell of a lot. So he can, at the drop of a hat, have a deep conversation about most things. And I think people in your position that are really good at what they do, they have a passion for what the hell is going on.
Thank
be
you.
It sport, be it politics, be it economics, all of that. If you don't, it'll show. But you've grown as an interviewer. I just started noticing you more, but somehow I think your radio also refined you as an interviewer on TV. Are there something in radio that's more bold, maybe more in-depth? I don't know. You can probably be more opinionated on radio than you can on TV. Am I right there?
Although I avoid the opinion, and I try to, I mean, one of the things that Islam for me was very instructive about in the way that I was taught, and the teachers I had when I was living in Iran, was about the sublimation of the ego. Because I know that a lot of what we do is driven by personality. You have to be a strong-minded person. You have to have an ego in the good sense. You have ego, which kind of ties in, it runs in tandem with confidence, right? But I don't want to have that, because I think that when we come with a particular point of view, already there's a lens that is filtering out so much, and there's a subjectivity that then creeps in. And my de facto position on my radio show, or whoever I'm engaging with, is to be as neutral as possible, but in a way that is able to direct, you know, questions around a range of things that people might be interested in. Often if we come with the dominant position and one narrative, we do a disservice to the people we meant to help, you know, to inform and to educate and entertain and so on. And you find, like, maybe the anti-ANC line is a very strong narrative in South Africa right now. The very anti-Zuma line is a very strong narrative. But there are many people who support the president. And they also need to be heard as to why. I mean, I was having a discussion at the dinner table this weekend with people who were talking about, we're so ANC. We have been, this is our home. norm. Mm. But our hearts have been so affected by what's been happening. And yet we can't say we can't vote for the party. But what do we do with this issue now around leadership? So, you know, you can't say to people in that situation, well, you know, you've got to make a clinical and scientific decision. That's not the way it works. Mm. People have to be understood from where they come and why they believe what they believe. So I take a lot of time in the morning to listen to what people are saying and not just to come with the response. We often listen with the response mechanism ready to deploy some answer. Can we just listen and let it rest there?
But it's difficult because I think I got this from my father. Very circumspect, big picture, see both sides of the story. Don't jump to conclusions. Don't just see one side, one view. There's two or three sides to a story. The world wants you to be opinionated. Though. The world wants you to put your stake in
they
the ground.
Love that. The world
they do, don't
that.
They?
Especially and, on Twitter.
Yeah, especially on Twitter. So I mean, so what you're saying is you obviously have opinions inside of you. You can't help but be swayed in a certain direction, a certain belief. But you try very hard to remain subjective and open
Can I just mention what Janine shows here, which is very critical from leadership point of view.
Not Janine. Janine's just left.
Sorry.
Iman.
She's someone I admire, though, so I don't mind being included.
Okay. What you are showing to us is this principle of closing the loop. Now, so your confidence isn't really in your opinion at the moment. Your confidence and trust is in the process of connecting with people, and then what comes out of that one could give a far more. And this is very important leadership principle. So therefore, it's not stuck to your tunnel vision at the beginning of the conversation, but what comes from it. And this is real mature leadership. I love that principle.
Really? Thank you. And I must come here more often because I've never heard people talk about me like this. So it's really self-affirming.
Do you see yourself as a leader? Sorry.
I think by consequence rather than by design, because, you know, I didn't set out in my career to become a television or radio journalist. These were gifts that were deposited at my door in both these very important roles that I fulfill. I was invited to take part. I didn't apply and say I would like to do it. So I'm very conscious of that. So, you know, I didn't set out. I knew that wherever I was, I often tended to be the one that people listened to a bit more, tended to value my opinion a little bit more. If that's leadership, then okay. You know, then I'm a leader. But I think why radio and perhaps television to a lesser degree is so instructive is because we come with our own myopia around whatever it is that we believe. And we have to, our borders, our own intellectual geography starts to change when we interact with people. And that for me has been the gift of radio because I would never pick up the phone and call someone in Soshanguve or Tembisa or Attridgeville or wherever.
They just come to you. Yeah.
They come to us. I mean, and so that point of view would have gone lost and ignored in my own journey. Mm-hmm. But every day I'm having conversations with people from many different communities in South Africa, and they tell me, no, Iman, it's not like that. It's like this. Mm. No, Iman, that narrative, this is what it means to me.
Can you allow that to influence you for your evening job? Can you actually allow that to influence you when you do those very quick, high impact?
Absolutely, because I think, as I said, you know, your intellectual geography is changing, it's widening, and it's becoming a lot more inclusive. So the questions maybe a couple of years ago that I thought, okay, this is the question. I kind of test it against the audience and think, would this be their question? Like, would this really be the one thing? Or is this a middle class perspective? Is it a working class perspective? Is it an elitist perspective? How do I ask the questions that most people in the country want answered? How do I use this, you know, the person in power or a leader or whatever to the best advantage to as many South Africans as possible?
That's maybe the difference I've seen during your television interviews. Is what is the word you use? Intellectual geography. Jeez, where did you come with that? Is it your own word or?
I made it up, but I think someone would have made it up before me. I'm sure.
That is a nice way of
You might have a question for you.
Is it a personal question?
No, it's not. It's a professional question. I was observing that, you know, when we look at 94, it was one of the best times to be a journalist, and so is this period. Yet, what is your view as to how journalism at this particular time is able or not able to decipher what's going on in the country?
Is it mature enough as well? I mean,
case in point, I mean, we see full page retractions and things like that.
Mm.
How do you see journalism in this current state?
Again, you know, if I look at what listeners or what the feedback generally is out there in the South African market and the market being ears and eyes, eyeballs on a page and ears around a radio set or streaming content live, is that there seems to be some level of, you know, questioning around, you know, is the media being corralled into a certain position? Is there a national agenda that's being set for them? What about accuracy? What about fairness? Because we can't talk about objectivity, I think, because it's still going to be subjective somehow. You can only hope to be fair, and you can only hope to be accurate, I think, in the reportage. So that's what people are talking about, which means that we have given, and you talk about retractions, page three retractions, or people getting taken to the ombud or whatever, that there have been mistakes made. How badly have those mistakes affected trust? Trust from people who rely on news consumption or on news reportage for their consumption of what the world really is like. And so I think we sit in a difficult position about, you know, where lines are drawn. And I'd like to make a comparison between the Caxton Press and the mainstream press. Oftentimes in these Caxton publications, you kind of get a sense of what the community is thinking about, you know, whether it's roads, service delivery, whether it's a local councillor that needs to be held to account, and what the real essence of conversation is in the communities. Look, they all can't make it onto the national platform, and so the harvesting is done on what reverberates for communities right across the country. But perhaps there is scope for us to reevaluate. But we live in a context where there is a multi-stream consumption or multi-platform consumption of news. So if you have access to the internet, it could be on Twitter or social media, or, you know, I mean, look at the big stories that have broken. Those have been harvested from social media.
Totally.
Facebook, for example. So the way we're interacting with the world is changing. And I think there's a lot more checking that people can do to see whether a story is credible, whether there is veracity in a claim or not. But it might not be the case for a number of people who don't have access, you know, to technology. It's
an interesting situation. You know what struck me now, Alice, as you were talking there with Iman, is 702 tried very hard to create this eyewitness news thing. So it's the community being reporters.
Beaming back. What's happening.
And that's what social media is in the community. It's right there. It's where the phone is. So the community is reporting what the heck is happening to some degree, but that's also being manipulated. Penny Sparrow may have been manipulated. Who's going to fetch a racist from somewhere that no one knows and blow that onto a national platform? It's quite amazing how, I don't know what is authentic these days. What the hell is authentic in many respects? Louis, you want to say something? Sorry, Mike.
Yes, Adrian, I just want to confirm. The feedback is one thing, the social media, but where the actual behavioral change happens,
conversations,
is actually in this kind of conversation. So therefore, you know, the feedback's one thing, but it's a conversation about these things at a local level, at any level, at the organizational level. If we learn to talk about it in this fashion and are prepared to change minds, that's when behavioral change happens. Not just in the feedback of information. That's just part of it. It's actually they're talking about it.
And Iman, you're really in the conversation game, aren't you?
I would say so. And a conversation is about shared opinions. It's about a back and forth. There's no imposition of one narrative over the other. And that's what's so instructive. People can, you know, make their point of view known on a number of different issues, and they can all differ. And you mentioned the Penny Sparrow thing. I mean, the reason it was instructive is, you know, we hadn't seen it in that level of ugliness, which is why it reverberated. Maybe if someone today posted exactly the same thing as she did, then we'd be like, you know what, she said the same, you know, she said what Penny Sparrow said before, and we're going to deal with this in this particular way. So maybe the response is going to be, would be slightly different now. But what it tells me is that, you know, with each conversation, there's a type of layering that happens in us as South Africans insofar that shape our response mechanisms. And I think, you know, that to me is instructive.
Mm. So you reckon that social media ought to be embraced rather than demonized?
I am for everything. I mean, if we could make everything free, like anything that allows people to engage with their world, you know, and I know people have, in certain countries, they censor content or they censor access to social networks and so on. To my detriment, I'm for everything that allows human beings to express themselves, because we live in a society that is so dictatorial about how we move. I mean, think about just even the South African context. You know, if you don't have money, you can't do many things. If you're stuck in your home, you don't have a job, or you don't have access to opportunities. There's so much there's a way of life that you can never be part of. Mm. And that to me is, you know, how can we still be in the 21st century where people suffer and live in that way? So I would say no, the freer things can be and the more open, the better.
We're almost done. Our time is up, and I need to end with a Sibanye executive inspirational thought. But before we go there, you interview from all angles. And the biggest debacle in the country at the moment, crisis, call it what you want, is the whole Zuma issue. Is there truth? Is there a truth in this whole situation?
truth, as you said, you know, someone said there are two sides to a story, and someone else said, well, there are two sides to a story, and then there is the truth, because your side and my side will be subjective. You know, the Zuma thing is instructive in many ways because it talks to the, you know, the use of institutions like the National Assembly. There are edifices attached to this whole story that we need to really grapple with. And it's interesting because this morning we're talking about the potential for electoral reform in South Africa and how that would look. Mm-hmm. So it's leading us to talk about a number of different things. There are those who say he stayed very much within the letter of the law. Others say, you know, he contravened the spirit of the law in the behavior of the party and the president in the aftermath of all of that. There are a number of anomalies and, you know, decisions that should have been made. Again, it is a narrative that's determined from where you sit,
totally.
You know, in the political spectrum in South Africa. But all the time, the fact that we're still talking, pardon me, and the fact that South Africans are still talking, means that we can talk. I mean, we're not shut down for talking. This radio station's not shut down.
Amazing, yeah.
You know,
so maybe the whole Zuma thing. Let's not try and find the exact truth, but let's say, what's the spin-off benefit of it? There's some, you know, how
is that we need to get involved, all
get
citizens.
Get involved and have these conversations, the Constitutional Court, the Public Protector, the clarity around this and that. So let's not find one truth. Is he good or bad? Is he right or wrong? Is he criminal or not? But it's confusing.
But and, clearly, I mean, it's a crisis, and often people say, you know, out of a crisis, there's always inherent opportunities. So, I mean, I agree with Iman. I mean, who would be talking about proportional representation versus constitutional representation, you know?
That sort of
thing. These are things that are coming out because of what we face.
Okay. Yeah, but sensibility, can I say? Mm. Sensibility above all. Let's be sensible about how we engage and move forward.
Yeah, one man or one woman's sensible view is different from another. But it is nice to have the conversations, and hopefully something clicks for one person and it changes their view. Iman, so good to have you here. Let me share with you one or two inspirational thoughts under the Sibanye Executive, our sponsor, and then we have your final comment. Maybe a message to leaders. Maybe you don't think they want to hear from you. I think they do. But any message you have for leaders, and then let's wrap it up. Make enough selfish, unethical decisions, and you will eventually lose perspective, courage, and integrity. I think that's what we see a lot of in our country. Ethical moral leadership is being honest or straightforward, not practicing deception. And I sent a lot of tweets this week about ethical moral leadership. So that's our Sibanye Executive inspirational thought or leadership thought for leaders out there. Iman, final word, thoughts?
You know, I can't harness one pithy, clever thing to say, but perhaps to go on something I said to our listeners the other day. You know, there's this whole notion called servant leadership. And perhaps that's where we really need to be. And always, maybe if everyone could have a little album of what it took to get South Africa to where it is today. I did a tribute to Solomon Mahlangu the other day, to have just a little album of all the people that bled and died for where we are in South Africa today, every day to almost pay homage to them, I think would make us a little more conscious about the decisions we make. How much are we selfish? Are we stealing? Mm. Are we lying? You know, to return to the essence of this big dream that was South Africa, which many of us got to live in, many others didn't.
The values that probably matter to all of us, actually. We don't differ when it comes to that level. That's Iman Rapeti. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, cool.
I'm just going to hand over to the next part of our show, and I'll join you outside in a moment.
Okay.
So next up is our business masterclass. Just a reminder, next week we've got Jose Dos Santos, CEO of Cell C. I sat two hours with him last week. Fascinating. And I really find him interesting. He'll be our leader guest next week. So you need to join us next week. Next up, our business masterclass. We're discussing a very interesting topic, procurement, planning, and sourcing. And USB Ed have brought their expert in, Hans Kohlmann. Richard Angus will get us going on this, and I'll be back in a moment. Thank you for joining us on the Leadership Masterclass. CliffCentral.com.